From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Past Lives and Reincarnation. Happy birthday, by the way, to Coast listener Jennifer. About a million Jennifers out there saying, yay, it's my birthday. Here's what's happening. Joe Biden vowed to unite America, torn by crisis and contempt Thursday night, accepting the Democratic presidential nomination and achieving a pinnacle in an unfinished quest that has spanned three decades for him and has been marred by personal tragedy, political stumbles, and more dynamic rivals. The past hurdles fell away as Biden addressed his fellow Democrats and millions of Americans at home who he hopes will send him to the White House to replace President Donald Trump. Though his triumphant moment was drained of immediate drama by the coronavirus pandemic, which left him speaking to a nearly empty arena rather than a joyously cheering crowd. We'll see what happens. The Republicans meet next week. Steve Bannon, a former advisor to President Trump, has pleaded not guilty in federal court in Manhattan after being indicted with three others in connection with an online fundraising campaign to help build the wall that prosecutors claim defrauded donors of hundreds of thousands of dollars. The campaign's website said all of the money raised would go to the government for building the wall, and that if they did not meet their fundraising target, they would refund every single penny, according to the indictment. They apparently raised close to $17 million. President Trump cannot block a prosecutor's subpoena for 8 years of his tax returns, according to a federal judge, and the latest setback in the U.S. president's longstanding effort to keep his finances under wraps. The North Korean government is reportedly ordering more decadent citizens to hand over their pet dogs so that other people can eat them. According to a Canadian news outlet called the National Post, South Korea's assistant reported that President Kim Jong-un from North Korea calls on pet ownership a byproduct of bourgeois ideology and is ordering dog owners to surrender those pets so they can be slaughtered and fed to hungry North Koreans. Our expert on such matters, Charles R. Smith, with us. Charles, are they that starving for food out there?
There are indications that we're seeing food shortages in North Korea and in China. This is kind of like the tip of the iceberg. Another event occurred just in the last 24 hours where North Korean patrol boats in the Yalu River actually shot up a whole bunch of Chinese fishing boats.
Jeez.
There were several people killed in this incident, and the traditional allies even seem to be at odds with each other. And this is mainly because, of course, the COVID virus striking at their agricultural systems.
And in this particular case, Charles, why don't we step up and help them with the food? We can supply them. Why don't we do something like that?
We would, but at this point, you got to remember, North Korea is pretty much denying that COVID even exists there, since they are the perfect society. We've seen the same thing kind of occurring over on the Chinese side with President Xi declaring that we have to have this clean plate program. So there are some indications on both sides of the line that their agricultural systems are in dire need of reform, and the COVID virus has caused spot shortages, and it might just get a lot worse.
Thanks, Charles. But eating pet dogs, geez. Singing does not produce substantially more respiratory particles than speaking at a similar volume, according to a new study. They study everything, but it all depends on how loud a person is, according to the initial findings, which are yet to be peer-reviewed. The project called Perform looked at the amount of aerosols and droplets generated by performers. Now, the findings could have implications for live indoor performances. Lyft and Uber Technologies received an emergency stay that will allow them to continue operations in California rather than shut down or be forced to reclassify drivers as employees instead of independent contractors, according to a report. Can a smile truly make everything better? A new study finds that even if you don't feel like smiling, faking one can have positive impacts. Researchers say smiling triggers certain facial muscles, which can trick your brain into feeling more positive. I had to get our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin, on this story. Peter, what is this?
Oh, I'm already laughing, George. It's one of those really stupid, objectified scientific studies that leaves out the human element totally. You know what they did, George? They actually had people bite on a pencil, you know, across the mouth.
And have that look, that smile look, right?
And then they said that's like smiling. And then the people seemed to have a little happiness afterward. I think they must have thought they were dealing with the craziest scientists in the world, and it made their day. It's just not what smiles are about.
Can you really trick your brain?
They don't trick your brain. They connect you to other human beings. So that when you smile, it gives another person a good feeling about you and themselves, and they smile back. And, you know, our brain, just to be a scientist, because I am, our brain is a social brain. It grows, it doubles in size the first year of life, and that learning to smile is all about what they're growing toward. They're growing toward being social human beings in that first year when they're being nurtured. And we love each other. We want to be with each other if we have half a chance. And smiling says we're not dangerous. We're friendly. We might even like you. If you have a cute smile, it can even mean, hey, I'd really like to get to know you, and so on. And George, you know what it adds up to is that wearing masks makes people not want to smile, and they can't. The smiles
you
can't
see. You can't see. What is new at Breggin.com?
Oh, my gosh. I have a huge coronavirus resource center. And I think that one of my blogs actually got through some people to President Trump. And I think as a result, he stopped the joint research going on that I mentioned to you earlier. He stopped the research. It cut off Fauci funding these building of worse and more deadly viruses jointly with China. So I'm really pleased about doing work in this whole new area. I feel like it's an obligation for someone who has some knowledge to
super. And we've got that link at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Look up in the sky. What do you see? Well, who knows? But Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center knows. Peter, what do you have for us this week?
Well, greetings, George. It's been a busy week. Late this afternoon, our trusty webmaster, Christian, updated the UFO Center website with the posting of some 476 new and revised eyewitness reports, among which are the following. And if time allows, I'll close my report tonight with a sighting just submitted by a young gal who already is a dedicated Coast listener from San Antonio. First report I'd like to address, I'll just touch on here because I alluded to it in passing last week, but I revisit it here again principally because the associated video is finally posted to the website, and it's some of the best photographic evidence I've seen for a long time, George.
Perfect.
If we have any listeners tonight who are interested in the UFO phenomenon, and I suppose that's probably just about all of them.
You're right.
If they'd like to see some of what I consider to be dramatic video, for which I have no ready explanation, I invite them to look at the entry posted on our homepage for Lakeview, Ohio, for Saturday night, July 18th at 11:45 p.m. It shows a very bright object, perhaps one-third to one-half the apparent size of a full moon in the night sky, which is a pretty prominent object at night, flying overhead and meandering all over the sky. It's worth taking a look at. Next report comes from Highland Village, Texas, for Saturday, August 8th. Essentially the same thing I've just described for the sighting over Highland or Lakeview, Ohio, and I'll skip over that. Third sighting is probably the most gripping one of the ones I present tonight. Burnett, Texas, roughly 50 miles northwest of Austin.
Lots of sightings in Texas, Peter, huh?
Yeah, I didn't intend for that to be the case, but that's the way it's worked out tonight. Two gentlemen, both very skilled amateur astronomers and photographers, saw an object for 3 hours and photographed it. And that photo is on our website at ufocenter.com. I'll let people read the two reports. Excellent reports and excellent photograph. And last couple of cases, just briefly, College Park, Maryland, two nights ago, a group of four people heard something coming at them, and when it finally came within sight, they saw a big disc that streaked across the night sky. And finally, I owe a debt to that young gal in her teens or 20s from San Antonio who called tonight. I told her if she got her written report to us before the program, I'd mention it. Excellent sighting of three discs over San Antonio tonight.
Super. Thanks, Peter. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, what's it like to be a medium, a profiler, to be able to predict future events, to communicate with the other side? In a moment, Allison Dubois back with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Born in Phoenix, Arizona, Allison Dubois became aware of her ability to communicate with the dead when she was 6 years old and when she received a visit from her deceased great-grandfather. After getting a bachelor's degree in political science from Arizona State University, she worked as an intern at the district attorney's office in Phoenix, and this got her interested in using these skills to help solve crimes. Allison now devotes her life to helping the living by connecting them with deceased loved ones. She's been the inspiration for the hit NBC TV series Medium, hosts a podcast called The Dead Life, is a noted author as well. Allison, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me on.
And great work you have done over the years. We've watched you evolve, and it's just fantastic. We're proud
Thank
of you.
You.
Really
Thank
proud.
Thank you.
How many books do you have out there now?
Six. I've published six books.
Good for you.
And Thank you.
Let's go back to when you were six. What happened?
I attended my first funeral. I went to my great-grandfather's funeral and saw him laying there. At six, you don't really know what a funeral is. You just know a lot of people cry.
Yeah.
And I thought he was taking a nap because you lay down to take a nap at that age when you're, you know, not feeling right. And my mom brought me home and put me to bed, and she closed the door, and I saw my great-grandfather standing at the foot of my bed, and he said, "Tell your mom I'm not in pain anymore and I'm still with her." And he had no lines on his face. There was no tension in his face. He died of intestinal cancer, so it was a very painful way for him to go. So for him to look so good, I was just happy to see him. So I jumped out of bed, and I knocked at my mom's door, and I said, "Grandpa wants you to know that he's not in pain anymore, and he's still with you." And she said, "Go back to bed." So I went back to my room, and he was not there anymore. So it really made me question what I was seeing. I knew I felt him there. I knew I talked to him. I saw him. But my mom's reaction let me know that I shouldn't share those things with adults anymore.
At that age of six, were you aware that he has died at that point?
I don't think I really understood what death was. That was my first death experience. And I think that's what really started triggering it at that age for me, was trying to understand the soul connection and what I was seeing. So as you get older and you have abilities, you exercise them even if you don't recognize that you're exercising them. So I'd be in church, and like most kids, you're bored. So I was head-tapping people, and I'd say, "Mom, you know, the guy in front of us, he's with a brunette, but I keep seeing him with a blonde." And she told me to shut up, obviously. And later after church, she said, "Yeah, there's a rumor that he's been seeing
another
woman, and she is blonde." And so I just thought I was seeing people's stories. I didn't really know what I was doing. I just knew it was a little taboo and that my mom would yell at me whenever I did it. So
could you consider yourself at that point a psychic as well as a medium?
Yes, because I was head-tapping people.
Yeah.
It came really effortlessly to me. I got bored really easily, and children with abilities start head tapping when we get bored. We're a little ADD.
Now, did anybody else, Allison, in your family have these abilities that passed them down to you?
Yes, it's genetic. I got it on both sides. I knew that on my dad's side that the aunts would have dreams where they would see deceased relatives, and they talked about it pretty openly, you know, as though it was normal. On my mom's side, my grandmother would stop the hands on clocks and say somebody's time just ran out, and it'd be a relative of ours who died at that time in another time zone, and we'd find out the next day that they had passed. So my grandma was who I would talk to about it. My mom wasn't real cool with it.
How did you enhance your abilities as the years went by?
As a teenager, you get turned way up because of hormones. And so I'd start telling my friends when they'd say, you have to meet my boyfriend, Jeff. And I'd say, yeah, I feel like he's still talking to other girls. You might want to tread carefully. And then they'd find out that their boyfriend was cheating on them, and then they'd get mad at me. I'm like, okay, so they shoot the messenger.
That's right. Get the messenger.
So as a teenager, I got turned way up. And then I had it in my early 20s. My husband just thought it was women's intuition, so he didn't really think a lot of it until I started interning in homicide. And it was my job to sort the crime scene photos to go to court. And I started seeing what was happening before the person was killed and getting a feeling on who killed them, what the motive was. You know, was it financial? Was it sexually motivated? And so I started getting these impressions. But even after our youngest daughter was born, I would hear the rocking chair rocking in her nursery next to us. And my husband would say, who is that? Like, who's doing that? And I said, it's your grandmother. She likes children. Until I actually brought through all of Joe's relatives that were in the house, they really didn't leave me alone. And that was right before I interned in homicide. So I was getting turned up again. And so then I was being studied by scientists at the University of Arizona, and they were contacted by Paramount. And Paramount said, send us some of your best mediums. And we were competing against each other for a show called The Oracles. And I didn't actually think I'd make it. I just wanted to see what other people were like in the industry, if they carried attaché cases, if they, you know, had college degrees, or are they all, you know, scarf-wearing, cat-toting, you know, long fingernail, you know, cliché versions of mediums. And I ended up making the five oracles because I found out that I was better than 135 other people. So that was something for me to learn.
I mean, you did television for about 6-7 years, didn't you?
I've been on TV now for 20, but the television series ran for 7 seasons.
That's pretty good. Now, when you communicate with the dead, do they come to you or do you go to them?
I've learned to put up my walls and distinguish my boundaries and borders with the living and with the dead. So when it comes to bringing them through, I can do it at will. It's not me going to them. It's that I'm a secretary to the dead. I can hear them. It's my client that is the magic. That's who they're there for. So I don't have to seek out the person. I just have to listen.
That's fantastic. And do we all have these abilities, or do we have to be tuned up?
As children, we're all more instinctual. You'll hear children more often say, grandma's in my room, or they'll talk about somebody that they see in the house, and it's because they don't have a chip on their shoulder. They haven't put up emotional walls. They are just the most innocent beings. But as we get older, if people pick on you, or like my mom kind of shut me down a little bit, you start to recognize that you've had your hand slapped, and a lot of young people will tell it to go away. And when you do that, it will go away. And then they want it back later, and it doesn't always work like that. Once you shut the door, it's harder to get it to open again. But people can work on enhancing their own abilities, and the more often you use it, the stronger you get. It's like a muscle.
Medium had about 128 episodes. That's huge for a television series.
Yeah, and it was really interesting because my daughters were friends with the actresses that played them, so I was actually watching 6 kids, you know, growing up, actually 7 because twins played my youngest, and it was a phenomenal experience, and I think it reached a lot of people and let them know that we may seem different, but there's more people that believe in life after death than people that don't.
We're going to take a quick break, Allison. We'll come back in a moment and talk more about your incredible abilities. Next hour, we'll take phone calls, and I understand you're going to do a little reading or two with some of the callers, too, but we'll do that next hour on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your calls next hour with Allison Dubois. A couple of her books include Into the Dark, Don't Kiss Them, Goodbye, We Are Their Heaven. Her website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with you along with Allison Dubois as we talk about her world and life as a medium and a psychic as well. She's been a profiler. You have three children, Allison. Do they all have your abilities?
I have three. We have three daughters. And when they were small, we saw it a lot. As teenagers, they were more interested in boys and cheerleading, so a little bit less. But now that they are in their early 20s, not to shock medium fans, but they're in their early 20s, and now they're more tapping into it more. Our youngest seems to be the most kind of in tuned and psychic of the three. But they all have talked about seeing, you know, they started it too, saying, there's somebody in my closet, and my husband runs in to, you know, maybe take a baseball bat to whoever it is. And she said, he's in the closet. So he opened the door, and there was nothing there. And then she said, it was a man with a bow tie, and she couldn't really say the word, but she said, he says he's a genius. And my husband said, that's my dad. My dad always wore bow ties and called himself a genius.
Wow.
Graduated MIT and was a chemical engineer. So, yeah.
It rubbed off on her.
It sure did. So it's genetic. You'll see it in your kids. If you see it in your kids, it means you've got it in your family tree. So you can't be mad at your kids for standing out, you know?
You can't. And did you encourage it, the abilities?
I did. I did encourage it. We played games with them, and finding Easter eggs at our house was different than other houses because I'd hide it in a neighbor's yard, you know, I'd hide it somewhere else and really challenge them to find these things. I'm like, close your eyes and visualize where it's at. So we've always encouraged it. They've enjoyed it, and they know it's not taboo and that it's natural, and they embrace it.
Has the dead ever scared you?
You know, the living I find more frightening than the dead, to be honest.
Yeah,
with you.
I don't blame you.
But I did have an occasion where we were in Prescott, Arizona, and we stayed in a hotel, Hotel St. Michael, which was over 100 years old. And I did get woken up by a pain to the middle of my back, and basically it's being stabbed in the back, like that sensation. And so I sat up, and I looked in the corner, and there was a cowboy sitting in the chair, and he was talking to me, and nobody recognized when he died because nobody cared because he wasn't that, you know, upstanding of a person. And I said, I'm sorry you had a sad life. I'm sorry that you died and that you weren't loved the way you deserved to be in childhood. And he smiled and he disappeared. So I guess that would be the time that I found the most frightening, just because I had to feel the pain sensation. But he wasn't trying to hurt me. He was just telling me how he died. So I wasn't mad.
Now, you consulted for the television show Medium on NBC, which was based on you, basically.
Right.
You're the inspiration for the program.
Right.
Of the 128-some episodes, how many were television-created, or how many were based on reality that happened to you?
You know, the family element to it was our life. That's our life. My husband Joe's a rocket scientist. You see our relationship and the push-pull that we have that is really the glue that keeps us together. And you see our daughters experiencing, you know, ghosts or spirits and what we went through in our daily life, or me coming home working on a case. You know, all of that's real. After a while, they ran out of cases to look at, and we didn't want to re-injure the victims' families by being too specific
right.
on a case.
Right.
So they changed the gender of the child, or, you know, that sort of thing. The pilot was really the most accurate to my life because it had me in Texas with the Texas Rangers working a case that happened. Hurricane Allison blew through and pulled up the topsoil, which made it harder for dogs to find, you know, the body. And so that one really hit home for me. There were a lot of episodes that were very accurate to our life, but spoiler alert, but it's been long enough, so if you were going to watch it, you probably did. My husband didn't die.
Perfect. And with Joe, I guess you couldn't use the phrase, it's not rocket science, Joe.
I love that. I'm one of very few people that when he has a hard problem to solve at work, I'm like, it is rocket science. Well, you know, it's going to be kind of hard.
I love it. Where do you go now, Allison, with this ability?
You know, I've worked cases for 20 years. I'm feeling a little tired. I'm not, you know, in my 20s and 30s anymore. You know, I'll work an occasional case. I do readings regularly around the world, so I'm still doing those, still writing books. Just wrote a book about soulmates, Love Can't Tell Time, that I'm proud of. And I'm really excited about my podcast, The Dead Life. I want to teach people what the other side and the dead are like through my eyes, not through gory or dark eyes, but I see the other side as light because the dead always tell me, we're more alive than you are. You're the dead ones. And so it's all perspective and how the dead are seen, and I want to teach people how to connect with them.
Well, good for you. Does it wear you out sometimes?
Yeah. I'm a trauma specialist, meaning I'm one of the few mediums that can really handle the homicides and suicides to the depth that I do without being shaken. So when it's a child, I'm more shaken by the reading than if it's a grandma dying in her sleep at 90. So sometimes you do carry some of it with you. You never forget the victims.
No. Tell us about the podcast, The Dead Life.
So I wanted to see what people's experiences with death have been. And so I actually just aired an episode where I interviewed hospice nurses that had sat with over 300 people at the time of death.
That's like a research study.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to see everyday people, how they see death through their eyes, and for them to share it with my listeners. And I'm pretty excited about it, but I also want to share episodes teaching people how to read signs, how to connect with the other side. Why are they still here? What do they want? You know, are we binding them here? No, they're not here out of obligation. They're here because they want to be. So I'm just trying to open people's minds to death and give them a different view of it.
What has been for you the most fascinating aspect of what you do, Allison?
I challenge myself, and I have attempted things connecting with the other side that either haven't been tried before, or I'm actually able to do it, which it's always so kind of thrilling for me. I can head tap people, so they said, "Can you head tap jurors?" And I said I could try. So that was my first going into court experience, and I head tapped the jurors, and I was able to determine, for instance, if somebody had victim energy, if a juror had victim energy but said they wouldn't, you know, they had a problem with our what we were looking to get as a sentence on the assailant. And so I'd go in and I'd put a jury together that they could flip the people that say they'd never give a certain verdict, and they did. So then I learned that I could do that and that that was possible. It was very exciting for me to see that I could help in the living world and make a difference.
Do you work with missing children in cases like that?
I have worked in missing children's cases. I usually am more focused working murder cases or suicides that deal with an 11-year-old or, you know, trying to get their parents to a place where they can breathe again is my job. Missing cases, a lot of the time, and I guess people wouldn't figure this, they end up being like runaways. And we ended up, I sent a detective to the door of where this one particular teenage girl was. I said, she's at her friend's creepy brother's apartment. So the detective went there and they opened the door and the girl was there. So a lot of the time we actually find them alive.
I would guess some of these cases have got to be heartbreaking for you, too.
Yeah. I mean, especially being a parent, I really feel for parents who have lost their children and why they yearn to be with them and try and help them through the depression so that they can, you know, get to the place of living again, rejoining the living, so that they recognize that every day that they wake up is a day closer to their child. They're moving towards them. They're not leaving them behind. The child's actually your present and future, not your past. So it's changing people's perspective, helps them to heal.
Do you bring this kind of work home, or are you able to leave it at the doorstep?
I was the biggest helicopter mom, I think, on the planet, because I had worked so many cases where a child would disappear three doors down, you know, just walking in between their friend's house and their own front door. So when it came to my kids, and because I had a background in child abduction prevention, I was very much so, I'd be like, they can stay at our house. I don't want you over there. I don't know whose cousin's there, whose uncle's there. So it does make you a little paranoid, but all of my children are alive. So that was really my focus. So as a parent, I had to empathize for children and their parents, the victims and the victim's family. But also in my own life, you're always waiting for that other shoe to drop with your own kids. And so you become highly protective, and I have been, not just of my kids, but I initiated the Amber Alert in 2000 for Arizona, and I served on the task force
Good
to design it. And I think if they knew who I really was at the time, they probably wouldn't have put me on the task force.
They might have been a little skittish, right?
Yeah, they would have been a little skittish, but I got the age raised to 17 for Arizona when it had been at 15 because they thought they would be mostly runaways. And I said, what about Molly Bish? She was a 16-year-old lifeguard, so she doesn't count. So they raised the age to 17. I was very proud of that.
What is like, or have you looked at a murderer in the eyes, either
I've
in
sat,
court or I've, otherwise?
Yeah, I have actually sat in courtrooms with people who stared at me and blew me kisses, not knowing why I was sitting on the prosecution side. And the bone-chilling feeling that you get from these people, knowing what their crimes are and the severity of them.
And knowing they were guilty.
Knowing they're guilty by DNA backing up that they're guilty, the body being found, you know, outside their apartment in a dumpster. And I mean, there was no doubt that these people were guilty, but just being around them makes you feel sick, and they're very dark energy, and they lack empathy. And it's really strange looking in their eyes because it's like looking in the eyes of a shark, and there's no feeling inside of them. So when I tap into their energy, it's actually hard for me to stomach it. So, yeah, I've looked in the eyes of killers before.
What are they like most of the time when the verdict comes down and let's assume it's guilty?
Right.
Do they break down? Do they sob? Or do they show any emotion?
Not the cases that I worked. They actually laugh. They laugh.
They laugh?
They think it's funny. They're just shaking their head and they don't feel like you can make them any more dead than they are on the inside already. So they just laugh. And it's the most horrible thing to see, turn and see the victim's family's faces.
Oh, my God.
When that's the reaction that they get. So I do deal with a lot of dark energy in what I do.
Even an apology is tough for the family of the of the victim. But, I mean, to see somebody laugh or just snicker is horrible.
Every courtroom I sat in, I worked six or seven. They were death penalty cases, so very severe cases. And every time, they were not sorry. There was no reaction from them. Actually, their families, the killer's family in the courtroom, usually will kind of go after somebody on the prosecution side. If you get up to go to the ladies' room, they'll kind of follow you. So it's very intimidating to be in that position and to know that they don't think that he's a bad boy. He's still a good boy, even though he committed this horrible assault and murder on a young woman. They think she must have done something to deserve it. It's just, it's the craziest environment to be in.
Allison, what are your dreams like?
You know, I like to take a melatonin and try not to dream at
just
night.
Just pass right out, right?
It's the only break I get is when I'm asleep. And I have a bit of a savior complex to where if I dream, I'm dreaming about trying to save somebody that's in danger. And so I just wake up exhausted.
Tell me about the new book, Love Can't Tell Time.
I wrote Love Can't Tell Time, Why Love Doesn't Die. For all of the readings I was doing, every now and then somebody would say, he's my soulmate or she's my soulmate. And I was seeing readings where they love their husband or wife, but then they marry somebody else a year later. And then there's people that are soulmates that they say to me, I've had more love from him and that it will last me a lifetime and I'll wait for him. He's all I need. And I found it so beautiful that I wanted to write a book that centers around what is a soulmate, the history of the study of what a soulmate is, but including stories of readings and letting the person that I read share their experience in the reading and the death of their partner from their own, you know, words, to share their words, and then I share mine. So I try and give a voice to the people who have lost the deepest.
You have kind of dealt with pets as well, haven't you?
Yeah. A lot of people do ask me, and I mean, I just did a reading today, and pets come through in the readings. They'll show me standing with their horse, you know, and petting it, you know, and say, I'm on a green pasture, and I've got my beautiful pony with me, or they're holding a curly-haired black dog, and sometimes I get the name, which is cool if I can get the name. Sometimes I can just get a name that's similar to the name because it's harder to hear their telepathy than it is human telepathy, which is what a reading is. It's them talking to me in my head. So the pets revert to a younger age just like people do when they die. We revert to the age that was our heaven on earth. And so, you know, when we were married, when we had children, when we won a heavyweight prize fight, whatever that may be, women are vain. We go back younger. We like to look younger. But the pets also go back to being a puppy or a kitten, you know, with a lot of energy. And there's somebody connected to you on the other side that loves you, that takes care of your pets until you get there. And I just thought it'd be nice for people to know that because I know how connected people are to their pets.
Allison, we're going to take calls with you next hour. And in addition to questions about your abilities, what do you require from a caller when they call in?
If somebody has a question about their own abilities even, or their children's abilities, I'm open to those questions. But I just need their first name and the month and day they were born.
Of the caller or the person you're going to look at?
Of the caller.
Okay.
And the person that, if they want somebody that's dead, some sort of a connection for me, it does help just to have the month and day they were born and the relationship, so wife, husband, son, and then I can just pull some impressions off of that.
Okay, and we'll let you chat with our listeners. The hour will fly by. Allison Dubois with us. Her website is her name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And again, her podcast is called The Dead Life with Allison Dubois, D-U-B-O-I-S.